You're listening to Profiled, a podcast by NCCM, the National Council of Canadian Muslims, where we profile leaders of our community who inspire us every single day. My name is Omar Kamisa, and each week we'll be sitting with these amazing individuals to talk about their lives, the lessons they've learned, and their experiences being profiled. Assalamu alaikum, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Profiled Podcast. As always, I'm your host here, Omar Kamisa, and it's my pleasure to be with you guys once again this week. Before we start today, I want to take a quick moment and just say a hearty and huge Eid Mubarak to all of our listeners. I know this Ramadan was a little bit different. I know we had to celebrate differently. We couldn't be with our families as much. We couldn't go to our parents' house for iftar or be with our cousins or our grandparents on Eid because of the lockdown and on quarantine. But I know we were able to celebrate it all in our ways. We saw the beautiful masjids that had people in their cars that were welcoming, still being socially distant, but being in our cars. We saw people that were doing Zoom conferences with their families, and the togetherness was still there, and it was beautiful to see. So I hope each and every one of you had a fantastic Eid, a fantastic Ramadan. You were able to connect spiritually, but you were also able to find the ways to connect emotionally with our families, even through these tough times. This week, we're excited to have a different kind of interview. Normally, I would be joined by the CEO of NCCM, Mustafa Farouk. We would sit down, the both of us, and have a conversation with someone that's a leader in our community. We would profile them, we would sit down, we would talk to them, but this is going to be a little bit different. Mustafa is going to take this one on his own, and he had a chance to sit down with the leader of the New Democratic Party, Jagmeet Singh, and have a chance to talk about the new normal, supporting Canadians post-COVID-19 and through COVID-19, and what he would recommend us to do at this time. So sit back and enjoy this conversation between Mustafa Farouk and the leader of the New Democratic Party, Jagmeet Singh.
Salam, and welcome to the National Council of Canadian Muslims Leaders Roundtable Series, sponsored by Islamic Relief Canada. I am your host and CEO of the National Council of Canadian Muslims, Mustafa Farouk. Today, I am so proud to be joined by the leader of Canada's NDP, Mr. Jagmeet Singh. Mr. Singh, welcome.
Thank you so much. Assalamu alaikum to all the brothers and sisters listening. Hi, everybody. I'm the leader of Canada's New Democratic Party, and I'm really honored to join Mustafa on this call.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's always, every time we have a discussion, it's always an incredible moment and opportunity. So thank you for coming on and having a chat with us today. Look, to start with, I think we have to acknowledge we're living through some very strange times with COVID-19 being what it is. So how are you managing and spending your time?
Well, Mustafa, I'm really worried about people in this crisis. A lot of people that are falling through the cracks and people that aren't getting the help they need. So I'm worried about that. On a personal note, I'm healthy. My family's healthy and everyone's doing well. But it's just that those folks that aren't getting the help they need right now and need that help that I'm really worried about.
So what typically are you thinking about these days in that kind of context?
I'm thinking about rent. A lot of people are struggling to pay their rent and their mortgage. Thinking about a lot of small business owners, friends of mine, who are struggling because they can't pay their commercial lease and their commercial rent, and they're worried about whether they're ever going to be able to keep their business running. And if it doesn't continue, then they're not confident that they can ever get back to that business again. I'm worried about people that are falling through the cracks because the CERB has so many loopholes where people who are genuinely in need of help are unable to apply because of a minor technicality, a small amount of money that they earn that means that they don't make the 5,000 threshold, or folks that are graduating from school that aren't able to qualify because they're neither students nor did they work before. There's just so many people, seniors, people living with disabilities, and that's why we've been saying that the CERB should just be universal. If anyone needs help, they should apply. If someone by chance gets help that doesn't need it, we can easily tax that back next year.
Is that basically like universal basic income, like UBI?
Well, we started off with that position that we should just send direct financial support to all Canadians, like a universal basic income to help everyone in this time. And we can easily tax back those who are able to contribute more in the next tax season. That was our starting point. And as a compromise position, we say there's already the CERB. It's working for a lot of Canadians, but it's just designed in a way where the Liberal government has this mythical person in mind who they're trying to exclude from enriching themselves. And instead of designing a program around trying to exclude someone who doesn't need it, in a crisis, in a pandemic, the priority should be designing a program where the people who need it most don't fall through the cracks. And if someone ends up getting some help because the program is generous to those who need it most, we can tax those folks back. And that should have been the way it was designed. And what we've been pushing for throughout this crisis is to broaden the qualification so that more and more people can get CERB, with our ultimate goal of making it so that anyone who needs it can just apply, get rid of the complicated criteria, and just make it a universal benefit.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried? Like, I know that many Canadians and many folks are worried, like, you know, how are we, and even, you know, with the current system, how will Canadians afford it in the long term for, you know, for folks who don't have an advanced economic degree? What does that sort of answer look like? Like, what is the future? I know asking people to prognosticate about the future is complicated, but and probably kind of unfair. But what does it look like in the future in terms of, okay, how would that look in the long term?
Namusta, this is a really, really important question, because we have evidence of both approaches in the past. In history, we've seen out of a crisis, governments take two approaches. One is where they invest in people. There is some debt that's accrued because of that. But then we see that those decisions resulted in a faster recovery and actually a better society and a fairer society. We also see the opposite, where out of a crisis, we've seen governments take the approach of cutting services and cutting benefits. And we've seen the results of that. It's actually made it harder for everyday people. There is more inequality, and the people at the very top make out fine, but it's very unfair for everyone else. So in this, there's going to be, and there's already a bit of talk about the fear of debt and the worry about how much this is all costing. And I really want to double down on this. The cost of not investing in people is far worse. And the evidence in history has shown if we take care of people now, if we lift each other up, if we invest in people, meaning better social safety nets and better healthcare, then we are going to come out of this stronger than before, and more people, every people will benefit. And that to me is really important, that the question be answered without any hesitation. We need to invest in people. And if that means making some difficult decisions, we have to invest in people, not in companies that will have blank checks where they can do whatever they want. We need to make sure everything is tied to directly helping workers and people.
So, I mean, one of the things that we at NTCM have been spending a lot of time thinking about in terms of those workers and in terms of helping Canadians have been the effects of COVID-19 on the charitable sector and the non-for-profit sector. Now, we know that in this time of crisis, the non-for-profit sector, whether that's food banks, domestic violence shelters, all of the wide range, you know, mental health supports have been critical in terms of playing a frontline response. But unfortunately, because of COVID-19, those non-for-profit institutions are taxed on both ends. So in other words, on one hand, they're facing a challenge where they are having increased needs. So more and more Canadians, unfortunately, are having to rely on the charitable and non-for-profit sector. On the other hand, you have a diminished ability of those charities and non-for-profits to fundraise. So we penned an open letter to Minister Hussein on the need for greater supports for the charitable sector. Some of the asks outlined in that letter have been met. So for example, our ask for a wage subsidy for folks in the charitable and non-for-profit sector, but others have not been met, such as our ask for improving the charitable tax credit and matching donations. Now, these are especially difficult times for the charitable and not-for-profit sector, which is in fact the size of our mining industry. So how would you suggest that we, that governments can better support the not-for-profit and charitable sector.
Well, you touched on this, and I think we should start there, is that the economic activity, or the, just put it simply, the number of people employed by the not-for-profit sector is pretty significant. The, you mentioned that it's proportional in size to many other large industrial sectors that we look at as job creators. So a significant number of Canadians are employed through the not-for-profit sectors. Millions of Canadians, in fact, are employed that way. And recognizing the impact that they have, not just on the betterment of society and better social cohesion and benefits directly delivered to Canadians, the people, there's also just this massive number of people that are employed through it. So we have a, I think that context motivates people to say, well, it's going to employ so many people and have such a big benefit, then we absolutely need to help the sector. So that's one. And then secondly, I think we need to push for just real, some of those suggestions you put forward as ways to help the not-for-profit sector. There's massive reduction right now for a lot of not-for-profit organizations in terms of the revenue that often come from donations. And now donations are down for a lot of organizations. And that's understandable given people have lost their jobs. So we need to, one, take this seriously, and two, follow through with all measures that will directly allow these not-for-profit organizations to continue to do the great work they do and to continue to employ the people they employ.
Mm-hmm. So what would be specific policy recommendations that you would have?
Well, supporting some of the suggestions you have around making it incentivizing the more, further incentivizing donations so that those who can give feel that there's a greater benefit in doing so. And then some direct financial support from the federal government. I think those are the two really key things. Revenue is down, so we need to find ways to backstop that loss of revenue. So making it easier and more desirable to make that donation is one, to boost up the revenue side from donations for those who can. And then the second is, in some cases, there's going to need to be direct financial support to continue the viability of some of these not-for-profits while we're going through this tough time.
I appreciate that. Let's change topic a little bit and talk a little bit about the effects that COVID-19 has been having on communities. Now, like, look, there's no way of getting around this. At least, I mean, I can talk about myself. It's been tough sort of staying indoors and, you know, it's not like the most exciting thing in the world to be in sort of self-isolation day after day. But I mean, I think we would be remiss not to recognize that the quarantine has had a pretty significant disproportional impact. COVID-19 affects those who are rich differently than it affects those who are poor. COVID-19 affects folks in a gendered way, from a gendered perspective. COVID-19 also affects folks from different racialized communities disproportionately. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about the latter, considering that that's sort of the expertise of the National Council of Canadian Muslims. Now, one of the great things we've been seeing during this time has been folks coming together to support each other throughout the COVID-19 crisis. So one example is like the Canadian Muslim Response Network, the CMRN, which has been engaging in like what people have been calling care mongering and service to the community at its best. However, I would say that there are some in Canada, unfortunately, that are seeking to undo the work of bringing Canadians together. And instead, they're preferring to sow divisions and cast aspersions along racial and religious lines. And maybe I'll give two examples of that. So the first example has been, unfortunately, an increase in threats against the Canadian Muslim community. While we still don't have any statistics to verify this, I can tell you that we've seen a pretty sharp intake of threats that are being made. 2 weeks ago, we had an individual in Edmonton drive by a local mosque and talk about his intention to go on a Ramadan bombathon. He then trespassed onto the property, started filming mothers and their children walking out of the mosque, and unfortunately, no charges have been laid. We've been seeing similar incidents of harassment to folks literally sitting on their property, where people telling them to go back to their country. We've been seeing, unfortunately, Nazi organizations threaten to bomb mosques and things like that. And we've also seen, unfortunately, on the other side, we've been seeing a really strong backlash to the desire by some Canadian Muslim communities to engage in the adhan, which is the call to prayer, in the same way that you know, many Christian organizations ring the church bells, and or people do the opera from their balconies or things like that. So I realize this is a long-winded question, but this is all sort of in setup to the question of how do you propose during this time that we deal with the question of hate and bigotry during the time of COVID-19?
The first step, I think, is to acknowledge that it is happening, that there is still, in a country like Canada, where we take pride in believing that everyone is welcome, that there is hate that exists, and that there are hate groups that are growing. And you've provided some, what you believe at this point is only anecdotal, but maybe there will be some evidence to back it up as in fact an increase. We know that one of the things that we've seen when it comes to hate is how connected it is. And it is very much like a fire. Once it allows to grow, it spreads and covers and consumes all. So once it's okay to hate someone based on their country of origin, then it's very easy to see hatred towards someone based on their spiritual beliefs, their religion, their ethnicity, the language they speak, the color of their skin. It's all connected. Hate is one of those things that is it spreads. And so during this crisis, we've seen hate against Canadians of Chinese descent, and that type of hate is this idea to blame someone for the struggles that we're going through. And it's wrong and needs to be called out. And while tensions are high, and I think economic inequality and struggles also allow some in the right to use the uncertainty and fear that people are going through to start to blame someone for it. And then often it's those who are racialized, those who othered, those who are made to seem different are the ones that bear the brunt of it. So Islamophobia specifically is a problem, and it is going to continue to be a problem unless we take a really strong stance against it. So you mentioned one example. I think we need to do more with our hate crime legislation so that it can be used specifically to deter violence or acts that are very clearly based on hate. It is different and has a different chilling effect on society when there's acts that are done, the criminal acts that are done, threatening someone, threatening to kill someone, threatening harm to someone. But when it's done with an additional lens of hate, where it's based on someone's identity, based on someone's religion, based on who they are, that has a broader impact than just that one individual act. So that's why it needs to be treated differently. And I think that's why some of the legislation we have can be used better. We need to keep better data. You kind of alluded to this. We need to be able to track this and say with confidence if it's increasing, so then we know that more needs to be done, or if we know that certain steps are not working, we need to come up with better or different steps. But these are some of the things I think we need to do.
Yeah, like, I mean, specifically around COVID-19, I mean, we've just addressed a lot of questions about data. I mean, we've seen in the U.S. that there's actually some data to suggest that, unfortunately, racialized Black communities in America are impacted significantly greater than other communities, and many have pointed towards the lack of you know, health supports and things like that in some of those communities.
Yes,
certainly to the best of my knowledge, we're not the same kind of data in Canada. Is that something that you think is important?
We absolutely should be tracking that data, and something I support. I support tracking data when it comes to measuring outcomes in all areas, whether it's in the criminal justice system and contact with police and carding, or whether it's in health outcomes, educational outcomes. I think it's so important to have the data to make the decisions. But just on that point, Mustafa, the idea that COVID-19, you know, initially or is disproportionately impacting people based on race. Initially, people started off talking about COVID-19 that it doesn't discriminate. And it became really clear that while a virus itself does not discriminate, the impacts on those who are most marginalized are very much discriminatory. So the fact that COVID-19 has clearly shown in the States to impact racialized people far more, is also tied very much to class. And I want to make that connection that it's poor racialized people that are the most impacted. And the connection between class and race, or race and class, that if someone's racialized, they're more likely to be poor and more likely to be vulnerable. And the more vulnerable you are, the poorer you are, the more likely you are to be exposed to COVID-19. And also your exposure to police. Someone who lives in a community spaced out with the ability to walk without being in contact with someone where they can physically distance, where they're in a large spaced out suburb, versus someone living in a community in a housing situation where they're very close to one another, and just simply stepping out the street means they're in close proximity. That shows, and then the police contact in response to that. We've seen in the States lots of examples, and I think some of those examples are also happening here in Canada, where racialized people are having more contact with the police simply because they live in communities where they're closer together, and then they are faced with more of a police response, whereas those who live in more affluent communities where they're more spaced out aren't getting the same police contact. So COVID-19 has impacts on race, ranging from not just the health outcomes where more people are being infected because of their vulnerability, but also people are having police exposure. And we've seen really troubling things out of the States that back that up.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the news about our brother who was running along the streets and jogging, and who the arrest was just made yesterday. I mean, we were all sitting around the table just like aghast this morning, thinking about what it's like to be a racialized minority in the States, and
absolutely
sickening to think about. Yeah. One of the things, I mean, you touched a little bit all about this question about the disproportional effects that class has on folks. And we're going to try to get through this question sooner rather than later. And it comes from our sponsor, Islamic Relief Canada. So we know that while Canada is fighting this pandemic, we know that countries in the global south, places like Yemen and Afghanistan, those are going to be harder, and the consequences are going to be more devastating. So how can Canada help those countries while at the same time helping Canadians as well? To bridge off of that question, we know that David Beasley, in a press conference, I think yesterday, for the world, I mean, he runs the World Food Program for the United Nations, talked about, pandemics and a hunger famines of biblical proportions, where the United Nations called for governments to contribute to a $6.5 billion fund to fight upcoming world hunger. So what sort of would your response be?
Well, I think the global pandemic shows that we are all connected. There is really no question to the idea that this pandemic is something that's shown how connected we all are. And that means that we need to work together more than ever. This is not a time to retreat away from that global citizenship. There might be an argument that globalization in terms of producing everything not in our country is something that we need to take a step back from. And there's some good reasons why we should be producing our own equipment in our own countries. But when it comes to the cooperation and working together in a collaborative sense with other countries, more than ever, we need to work together to fight the pandemic, but also then to look at the impacts, because impacts are going to be global, and there's going to be folks that are going to be more impacted than others. There's going to be those who are worse off than others. And we have a global responsibility as a part of our shared compassion and humanity that we take care of one another, not just in Canada, but we do our part globally to take care of those around the world. And the food shortage is one that we're seeing a lot of evidence that might also impact folks in North America. So with the shorter growing cycle in North America and troubles with employment, we will face it in Canada, but I can only imagine how much worse it'll be in other countries. So yes, we should be playing our role in being a part of a response that shows and showcases humanity and compassion with our fellow human beings. And that idea of wanting to take care of one another should extend beyond just our neighbors and our own cities and our own communities and our own country, but to be a part of a global response as well.
My last question for you relates to mental health. To the fact of what people are sort of doing indoors. So, I mean, look, staying indoors and staying physically isolated from friends and family can be especially difficult for many. What mental health supports are in place to support Canadians struggling during these trying times? And what would your recommendations look like on a go-forward basis? What are you thinking about advocating for?
Well, right now the response has been insufficient when it comes to mental health, particularly because there is already a stigma associated with mental health, and then isolation and physical distancing are exacerbating the problem, making it harder on folks. So mental health is the mental health of people is being impacted by the crisis without a question, without a doubt. So what we've called for in the past is really recognizing mental health as a part of our healthcare system, as an inextricable part, or part that you can't remove. It is very fundamental. Our mental health impacts our overall health and well-being. So we'd like to see our healthcare system really take a robust approach to mental health, including those services into a universal public system. And in the short term, we need to ramp up access to mental health services. Right now, it's going to be difficult to have those services in person, but there's online, telephone, and many other ways to deliver the services that we need to really explore. And the existing services need to be redoubled and increased in capacity to help with what will be already increasing numbers of cases of people struggling with mental health, but even more so as this pandemic continues. So it's something that we need to really focus on and have a strong response to.
No, I appreciate that. It's something that I've been thinking about a lot, unfortunately. I mean, I've had so many friends call me in the last little while, losing jobs, the challenges of staying at home. It's tough times for folks. And I just want to say to everyone who is listening that, these are tough times. Our religion teaches us that we're not supposed to minimize those harms. If you're feeling stressed, if you're feeling isolated, seek help. You shouldn't feel stigmatized because you're going through a tough time. These are times when we need to open our arms and embrace each other, if not physically, but socially. I think that needs to happen. So make sure that you are trying to seek help. Mr. Singh, I'm going to give you time to make any closing remarks. If there is one or two things that you want people who are listening to this to walk away from, to keep as a message, what would that be?
Certainly. Well, I want to build off of just what you just said. Not only should people reach out if they need help, they should absolutely do that. And I know it's tough to do, but please do so if you need help. Also, if you can, reach out to your loved ones, reach out to those close to you, and do a check-in, because there might be people suffering in silence, so definitely check in on them during this stuff. I would say a couple of things just in closing. One is that I know that there's a really great feeling in Canada and amongst people of wanting to take better care of one another. And I think that that is a really powerful thing coming out of this. And we need to do that, and we need to nurture that feeling, because it's going to be very easy for some people to come in and push back and say no, because of debt and other concerns are going to discourage this idea of taking care of one another. And I think that we shouldn't be imagining what a return to normal is. We shouldn't be talking about going back to normal and when will things go back to normal. We need to move forward to something better, because we've seen this in this crisis that our existing social program and the inequalities have been massive, and that the programs have been insufficient to respond to those inequalities, and people are hurting. And so out of this, we need to do better. And so we need to build a better healthcare system where we take better care of one another. We need to have a better social safety net. We've seen that EI is designed in the 70s and doesn't really respond to the needs of people. And that's why we had to push the government to develop something like this ERB, something broader. So we need to have that coming out of this. And I think about people going back to work more than ever. Workplaces need to be safe. You need to know that you're not going to get sick if you go back to work. And people need paid sick leave. Like, that should no longer be an option. Everybody in our country should have paid sick leave. In the short term, it's something that we should deliver federally, but eventually it should be legislated. If a worker needs to stay home because they're sick, they should not have to wonder if they go to work, they might infect their colleagues, but if they stay home, they're not going to get paid, so they won't be able to pay their bills. That choice should never happen. That impossible choice should never happen. So I guess in closing, it's tough, I know, and we're going through a difficult time. The only way we get through this is if we take care of one another. And coming out of this, we have to be better. We don't want to go back to normal. We want to move forward to something better, where we take better care of one another. And then we'll truly come out of this crisis stronger than before.
That brings us to the end of this week's episode. I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation between Mustafa Farooq, the NCCM CEO, and the leader of Canada's NDP, Jagmeet Singh. If you want to get a hold of leader Jagmeet Singh or find out what he's been up to lately, you can follow him on all of his social medias. On Facebook, he's at Jagmeet NDP. On Twitter, he's the Jagmeet Singh. On Instagram, it's Jagmeet Singh. And I believe he has a TikTok as well, where you can find him at the Jagmeet Singh. And if you enjoyed this week's episode, please do remember to give us a rating and a review on iTunes. It would honestly mean the absolute world to us, and we can only get as far as you guys will take us. But that brings us to the end for today. Thank you guys so much for your time, and inshallah, we'll check back in next week. Masalam, and stay safe. You've been listening to Profiled, an NCCM podcast. Be sure to follow us on social media. On Facebook and Twitter, it's at NCCM. And for Instagram, it's at NCCM_community. Thank you for listening, and be sure to check back next week.